Dr. Heather Loy is a professor of psychology at the King's University College in Edmonton, Alberta. After receiving both her undergraduate and master's degrees in psychology from Queen's University, she earned her PhD in psychology from McMaster University. The focus of her dissertation research was on sweet taste reactivity and the hedonic response in humans. She is co-editor of a book published in 2009 by Baker Academic entitled A Science and Religion Primer, as well as two book chapters and numerous articles and conference presentations related to gender and sexuality, behavioral genetics, the hedonic response, and various faith science issues. She was a participant in the Sir John Templeton Oxford Summer Seminars in Science and Christianity from 2003 to 2005. This afternoon, Dr. Loy will be speaking to us about reorientation therapies and same-sex desire. Are they effective and ethical? Let's welcome Dr. Loy.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm just wondering if there was going to be a picture. Thank you. That's lovely. Let there be light. Okay, well, it's good to be here with you. I apologize in advance if my voice goes in and out a little bit. One of those summer cold things. I'll do my best. The question before us today is it ethical to offer therapy to assist people who would like to change their sexual orientation? This seems on the surface to be a very simple question. However, as I have discovered, pursuit of an answer leads into a labyrinth of complexly interconnected observations, science, politics, and worldviews. I can't offer here an exhaustive examination of all the relevant aspects of this story. Instead, I will focus on a few elements I believe to be central: the context, the science, and the questions that both of these raise. Be warned, there are no easy answers. I come to this topic as a biological psychologist interested in human sexuality and gender, and as a professor and friend who has walked with and listened to students, family members, colleagues, and friends who encounter same-sex attraction in themselves or people that they are close to. If you remember nothing else from this talk, I hope that you will at least remember that we are not speaking merely of abstract concepts like sexuality and gender, but about real human beings with names and communities, commitments and questions. We are speaking of ourselves, our families, co-workers, friends, neighbors, sisters and brothers in Christ. Even if we don't have tidy answers, we can still seek increased understanding and translate that understanding into effective ministry. Well, why not offer treatments to help people with conditions that they find distressing? Many people have sought therapy for various psychological and neurological conditions. We had some examples just a few minutes ago with Dr. Jones' talk. We go to psychologists and psychiatrists and are treated with anything from drugs to exercise to talk therapy. We trust these professionals to tell us what is wrong and what options are available to deal with the problem. Imagine then Sam, a young man, 19 years old, who comes to a psychologist and confesses that, despite trying very hard for many years, he just isn't sexually attracted to women. It's other men who really turn him on. As far as he knows, no one else in his community has this experience. His parents have started pressuring him to bring home a nice young woman, and all their expectations for the future center around his marrying and eventually starting a family. Yet he has absolutely no desire to do this if it involves being intimate with a woman. He doesn't know what to do with these feelings, and he comes to you asking, "What is wrong with me?" Until about 40 years ago, any North American mental health professional would have answered this question by saying that the problem is the same-sex erotic desires. They would have diagnosed Sam with a type of sexual deviation called homosexuality. The goal of therapy would be both to reduce the same-sex erotic attractions and also to increase heteroerotic desires, or at least enable Sam to function heterosexually. Between 1971 and 1975, the major professional mental health organizations, such as the American Psychiatric Association and the American Psychological Association, both of which unfortunately abbreviate as APA, officially and dramatically altered their view of same-sex attractions. They removed homosexuality as a diagnosable mental disorder after being pressured to get past unquestioned assumptions and to pay close attention to the data. These data consistently show that having homosexual desires, in contrast with genuine mental disorders, implies no impairment in judgment, stability, reliability, or general social or vocational capabilities. Today, the received view is that homosexuality is not a mental illness. People who experience distress at their same-sex attractions are actually experiencing an internalized homophobia, or they live in a context hostile to homosexuality. And that sexual orientation is a stable trait, not amenable to change. One discovers one's sexual orientation. One does not choose it. These organizations work hard to encourage all countries to repeal laws that criminalize homosexual acts between consenting adults and to remove the stigma associated with same-sex desires. If our young man Sam came to a mental health professional today, he would most likely be told that he did not have a mental disorder. The only problem, if any, would be his distress, depression, or anxiety about his same-sex desires, not the desires themselves. Therapy would focus on helping him fully discover his sexual orientation, accept his sexuality, and find ways to live with integrity. There would be no suggestion that Sam should attempt to alter his sexual desires. But let's imagine that Sam is a devout and committed member of a religious community that happens to have a clear and strong position that same-sex desires are inherently disordered, to use the Catholic phrase, and that it is sinful to engage in same-sex fantasies and behaviors. Sam shares these views. Yet Sam's desires are very strong. He aches for intimate relationships, but with other men. He despairingly pictures a future of deep loneliness and isolation. He could simply admit to himself and his community that he has these same-sex desires and, like the alcoholic, pledge and seek support to remain forever celibate, meeting his relational needs through non-sexual friendships. This is much easier said than done, as the longing for intimate physical connection is powerful, and celibacy has always been understood as a calling, not a prescription or a treatment. Sam, however, also longs to fulfill his own and his community's expectations that he marry and have a family. He wants to want these things, and yet the thought of heterosexual intimacy leaves him cold. He doesn't think this would be fair to any woman that he married. What is a young man in this situation to do? Where does he go for help? He may turn to organizations such as these. Exodus International, or the National Association for Research and Therapy of Homosexuality, commonly known as NARTH, or to therapists such as Joseph Nicolosi at the Thomas Aquinas Psychological Clinic that provides support for people in this dilemma. These organizations are run and supported primarily by evangelical Christian Protestants in the U.S. Exodus and NARTH try to support people with same-sex desires who live in and embrace the values of communities that view these desires or their expression as immoral. They help them to make peace with and decisions about their irreconcilably conflicting life choices and chances. So you can see here, these are just quotes from their websites, the approach that they take. We believe homosexuality to be a multi-causal developmental issue and that any individual can experience freedom through the support of caring individuals and the healing power of Jesus Christ. And NARTH offers hope to those who struggle with unwanted homosexuality. We disseminate educational information, conduct and collect scientific research, promote effective therapeutic treatment, and provide referrals to those who seek our assistance. And as you can see from those quotes from the websites, these organizations go further than offering ways to cope. They offer hope that same-sex desires can be changed. For example, the headline on Joseph Nicolosi's webpage reads, "You don't have to be gay." There are several multimodal types of therapy available to help people change their sexual orientation. These are collectively known as reorientation or conversion therapies. Both the APAs and many other organizations are very concerned that conversion therapies may be unethical because they offer a promise that cannot be kept. They argue that there is no good scientific evidence that such therapies work, that they can result in despair, shame, and self-blame when clients fail to experience real change, and that simply advertising such therapies contributes to a climate of negativity about same-sex desires. On the other hand, proponents of reorientation or conversion therapies counter by claiming that literally thousands of clients have not only come to peace with their same-sex desires, but have experienced a reduction in those desires, and that many have gone on to maintain successful heterosexual marriages. What are we to make of these apparently conflicting claims? The answers are critical, but because before we can consider whether a therapy is ethical, we need to know whether or not it is effective. Effectiveness is not a sufficient condition for a therapy to be ethical, but it's certainly a necessary one. So, let's evaluate these therapies. Let's start with research that examines whether conversion therapies present a significant risk of actual harm to clients. Positively, even when clients fail to experience a change in same-sex attractions, some report increased feelings of fitting in, strengthened emotional non-sexual same-sex relationships, congruence between sexual feelings and personal values, and improved gender identity. However, several studies report, in addition, numerous disturbing negative outcomes. They include, and this is not an exhaustive list, long-term sexual dysfunction, lowered self-esteem, elevated self-hatred, loss of family and religiosity, or anger at family and community, elevated depression and anxiety, suicide attempts, spiritual crises, phobic anxiety of attractive same-sex persons, increased aggression and hostility, and frustration at wasted time and resources. More directly to our question, though, do they effectively alter sexual orientation? The central tenet of conversion therapy is the claim that it can produce significant shifts in sexual orientation, moving a person from a primarily homosexual to a primarily heterosexual orientation. These therapies have been around for a long time and were particularly widely used in the 1950s through the 1970s, especially before the 1973 APA decision to declassify homosexuality as a mental disorder. They included everything from surgery to hormone injections, based on the idea that gay men were somehow lacking testosterone and gay women had too much, neither of which treatments ever worked, by the way. Psychoanalysis and also behavior therapies. Behavior therapies included aversion conditioning and covert sensitization. Aversion conditioning involves pairing aversive stimuli, such as painful electric shock or nausea-inducing drugs, with homoerotic stimuli. Basically, you look at pornographic homoerotic pictures, and if you start to feel aroused, you get either zapped electrically or you start throwing up. Covert sensitization is a little less direct. Here, the client imagines engaging in the undesirable behavior and also imagines a negative consequence, such as being publicly humiliated. Both techniques have long been popular in the treatment of sex offenders, so their application to same-sex desires was a natural extension. While surgery and hormone treatment are no longer used, psychoanalytic and behavior therapies continue to be offered under the umbrella of conversion therapy. Reparative therapy is the most well-known and widespread form of conversion therapy. Clinical psychologist Joseph Nicolosi developed this therapy out of his theory of the cause of male same-sex attraction. In brief, working from a psychoanalytic perspective, he argues that young boys who do not behave in gender-typical ways are often rejected or ridiculed by parents and peers and come to feel inferior to other boys. They internalize the belief that they are not real boys and thus engage even further in gender-inappropriate behavior. These boys develop same-sex attractions, according to Nicolosi, because they are seeking from other males the masculine qualities they believe are lacking in themselves. Repairing, which is where the word reparative therapy comes from, repairing this internalized sense of failure as a male should result in the disappearance of same-sex attractions, at least for men. Not all conversion therapies assume this particular developmental path toward male same-sex attraction, but they all do assume that there is something disordered about a person's gender identity and or their relationships with their same and other sex parents. There is a small academic literature that evaluates the success of these various treatments in changing sexual orientation, and there are a couple of reviews of this literature. These reviews show that there is such a diversity of sampling, methodology, and measurement that it's actually really hard to determine whether any of it ever worked or works. In the research, success is defined in various ways. Some reduction in same-sex attractions, and how much of a reduction is necessary to be for therapy to be viewed as successful varies tremendously. Reduction in same-sex desires, fantasies, or behaviors, increases in interest in the other sex, an ability to engage in heterosexual sex. Note that a decrease in same-sex erotic desires is not necessarily reflective of a shift toward heterosexuality. It could simply reflect an overall reduction in sexual libido, and that is, in fact, one of the very common outcomes of these therapies, is that people just stop getting interested in sex, period, because especially if you use those painful behavior therapies, the very thought is associated with really unpleasant consequences. One researcher reported that even when slight shifts were obtained in the heterosexual direction, shifts in desires, attractions, fantasies, and so on, stressful events frequently caused a shift back in the homosexual direction, in some cases threatening marriages and families that were formed after this person went through therapy. Studies also varied in how long after therapy the changes were assessed. In most, it was immediately after the therapy concluded. In a few, it was a few months. None reported on the effects a year or more later, except for one recent study that focused solely on individuals who reported a change lasting at least 5 years after therapy ended. A very few studies used physiological measures where sexual response to homoerotic and heteroerotic stimuli was assessed. Most of the studies used retrospective and self-report measures. Data from retrospective and self-report techniques, while they are widespread in all the literature that assesses the effect of all kinds of therapies for all kinds of conditions, so it's widely used, but it's hugely problematic because people who have invested time, money, and emotional energy into a particular therapy are highly motivated both to perceive and to report significant changes as a result of the treatment. What you often observe happening, and very carefully controlled studies have been able to demonstrate this across a wide range of things, not just sexuality, is that people tend to exaggerate how bad they were at the start of the therapy and exaggerate how much they've changed at the end of the therapy. And if you are able to come up with measures that, at the beginning and at the end that get around this desire for it to have worked and for it to have been a real change, you discover that the changes are often a lot smaller and sometimes they completely disappear. So these are difficult measures to interpret. Not surprisingly, uncontrolled studies report much higher success rates than controlled studies. These uncontrolled studies include one retrospective survey of nearly 900 clients of reparative therapy in which a significant percentage reported a perception that their same-sex desires had diminished over the course of therapy. You'll notice that one of the authors of this is also one of the United States' strongest proponents of reparative therapy. I'm giving you these references because I understand PowerPoints will be made available to people, and if you want to look them up, then you are welcome to do so. Another recent and widely publicized study of the efficacy of conversion therapy was by Robert Spitzer. How many of you have heard of this, by the way? Or the name Robert Spitzer? Okay, just a couple of you. Robert Spitzer is the psychiatrist who led the movement to remove homosexuality from the American Psychiatric Association's DSM back in 1973. And he has become recently famous or infamous, depending on your perspective, for publishing a study first reported at a conference in 2001 and published in 2003, in which he talks about the efficacy of conversion therapy. And some people think he's a traitor, and some people are thrilled. Spitzer recruited only those individuals who had experienced a change in sexual orientation, mainly through reparative therapy and ex-gay organizations. He managed to find 200 individuals who retrospectively reported that their same-sex attractions were reduced and had remained reduced for at least 5 years over the course of what was, on average, 5 years of therapy. It should be noted that it took Spitzer several years and persistent effort to find his 200 participants, and that the majority, 78% of them, were strong and outspoken advocates of the value of reparative therapy in their communities and their churches. In the end, one early group of reviewers of this literature on conversion therapy concluded that... Sorry, there's the Spitzer article, so if you need to get that down, you can. This early group of reviewers concluded, although several reorientation techniques have achieved moderately positive results, research is sorely needed on ways to improve the efficacy of the procedures. The procedures involved do not yet operate at a level of sophistication and validity that will allow clinicians to place much faith in the procedures and use them in a competent manner, assured of the potential for success. Current American Psychological Association's ethical standards and guidelines for therapists require that therapies meet at least some of the criteria for what they call empirically supported treatments, or ESTs. And another more recent set of reviewers, who included the studies by Nicolosi and Spitzer that I just mentioned, conclude, as a result of reviewing all this literature, that conversion therapies appear to lack an empirical basis as a treatment option. Spitzer himself concluded that while some strongly motivated individuals appear to have successfully shifted their desires toward the heterosexual end of the spectrum, none reported a complete loss of same-sex attractions, and more important, his sample likely represented an unusual subset of the many thousands of individuals who have sought change through conversion therapies. This is Spitzer's response to his own data. In other words, there is no good evidence that conversion therapy works reliably to change sexual orientation, and considerable evidence that such therapies can cause harm. By any ethical standard, then, conversion therapies appear to fail the test. What then are we to do with studies and anecdotes and other claims that some people do experience changes in sexual orientation? Are they all lying? That seems unlikely. Something else must be going on. In order to explore this question, we need to press more deeply into, oh my goodness, exactly what we mean by sexual orientation. I must have talked to myself a lot faster than I'm talking to you. Okay, hang on to your hats, it's going to be quick. The usual definition of sexual orientation promoted by the American Psychological Association is that sexual orientation refers to an enduring pattern of emotional, romantic, and/or sexual attractions to men, women, or both sexes. It also refers to a person's sense of identity based on those attractions, related behaviors, and membership in a community of others who share those attractions. The APA goes on to assert that sexual orientation is an enduring characteristic of a person, and yet at the same time, there is an acknowledgement by the APA that recognizing, integrating, and expressing one's sexual orientation is a lifelong developmental process. As a scientist, I find this definition problematic because it seems overly complicated and to at least potentially conflate several different aspects of identity and behavior. So let's unpack it a bit. This definition of sexual orientation draws together sexual and affectional feelings, gender identity and role, sexual behavior, and social identity. The assumption is that all of these things are normally wrapped up in a singular package, so that if you know something about one of them, you can predict all the others. Thus, we imagine that normally speaking, if you are a woman, then you will automatically have your sexual desires will be directed to men. You will identify yourself as straight, as your sexual identity. You will think of yourself as female. You will act like a female in your culture. Whole package comes together. More exceptionally then, if you are a man who is sexually attracted to men, it is assumed that you will also be invariably affectionately attracted to men, engage in homoerotic behavior, and identify as gay. Recent research suggests that it makes more sense to view these dimensions as somewhat interconnected, but also somewhat independent. The relative proportion of same-sex desires, fantasies, and behaviors varies along a continuum, sometimes called the Kinsey scale. Although we tend to categorize people into three groups, homosexual, bisexual, and heterosexual, it's important to recognize that these categories don't really exist in nature. While there is evidence that some people shift along this continuum over their lifetime, women more often than men, it's very important to distinguish between something that can change and something that can be changed. In other words, these shifts may not be amenable to deliberate conscious efforts. It's also important to recognize that even this Kinsey scale conflates sexual feelings and sexual behaviors, so it's hard to interpret what shifts on the continuum might mean. These sexual feelings may be more stable than any other aspect of sexual orientation. This is certainly the view based on current research. And while it makes intuitive sense, it does reflect a rather reductive view of erotic desire as if it's something that wells up within us as a result of genes and physiology, not as something that might be at least somewhat amenable to social influence. Nevertheless, this position is consistent with research that shows that erotic desires are frequently experienced as emerging even despite conscious choice and socialization, as is evidenced by somebody who might discover homosexual desires within themselves when they really don't want to experience that. But despite a huge literature on the question, nobody really knows how a person comes to have particular sexual desires. Nicolosi's reparative drive theory is one of many. There's evidence for a role for genetic factors and prenatal hormones or antibodies in interaction with various subtle and complex processes during development and socialization, and a growing consensus that there is more than one path through which a person might develop same-sex attractions. Further, people are not automatically sexually attracted to any and every member of a particular gender, but to specific individuals. These individuals may or may not fit the gender category you might expect given their adopted sexual identity. For example, a woman who thinks of herself as straight may for a period of time find herself in love with and sexually attracted to another woman, while a man who thinks of himself as gay might happen to fall for a woman. Despite changes in sexual behavior, such people do not always change their sexual identity. What's clear is that the relationship between having same-sex desires and one's sexual identity is not linear. Sexual identities are social categories that people adopt based on a complex range of factors. Some people with strong same-sex desires never identify as gay or lesbian. Some with a mixture of same-sex and other sex desires may identify as bisexual, gay, or straight. People also occasionally change their sexual identity over their adult life, whether or not their basic desires have changed. These observations have led to a distinction between sexual and affectional feelings, where sexual desire is viewed as a basic motivational state facilitating reproductive behavior that's viewed as gender-specific, because you can, after all, only reproduce with somebody of the other sex. Affectional feelings are believed to be rooted in the infant-caregiver bond, which is not gender-specific, but is a bond and a capacity that we carry throughout our lives in order to motivate social alliances and the networks we need to function in community. And Lisa Diamond's work suggests that these are independent motive systems, but that they can mutually influence one another so that you can fall in love or fall in friendship with people of either gender. Now, I'm going to skip a bunch of things that I was going to say here because I know I'm out of time. In light of these observations, it seems far too simplistic to equate love with sex and to reduce sexual orientation, broadly speaking, to two categories of gender, male, female. Are you male? Are you female? Are you attracted to males? Are you attracted to females? It's not quite that simple. These relationships are much more nuanced and complicated. So it's not too surprising that reports keep surfacing of people changing some aspects of their sexual orientation. It may even be the case that Nicolosi's reparative drive theory accurately captures the history of some men. And when people report changes in their sexual orientation, they may well be reporting changes in their fantasies, which are under conscious control, their behavior, their affectional ties, or their social identity, whether or not their core erotic desires have been altered. It may also be the case that many who report successful experiences with conversion therapies have sexual desires that lie somewhere between the extremes and the Kinsey continuum and have managed to focus on or develop the heteroerotic aspects of those desires. Finally, the discovery and acceptance of the idea that love doesn't always include sexual attraction may enable some people to engage in fairly fulfilling marital relationships despite a lack of sexual interest. The key conclusion here, however, is that any account of sexual orientation that claims to explain everyone's story and provide the solution, whether full acceptance or reorientation for all, should be treated as suspiciously oversimplified. Now, really briefly, conversion therapies are viewed by the major mental health organizations in North America as unethical because they try to change something that isn't a disorder, can't be changed anyway, and contribute to a hostile environment for people with same-sex desires. The solution to the problem is to change, escape, or reject your community rather than your internal desires, which are viewed as stable and not amenable to change. Less mainstream organizations that promote conversion therapies argue that they are ethical because they deal with a real disorder that can be changed and that people freely choose to seek such therapy and they have the right to do so. Their solution is change, escape, or reject your internal desires in order to continue to function in your community. What we've got here are different worldviews that are functioning, where the major mental health organizations take an individualistic, autonomous, self-determined view of the individual, whereas conversion therapists and related organizations tend to be more communitarian, authoritarian, and theocentric, although they both appeal to the opposite set of values when, for example, the conversion therapists appeal to autonomy and self-determination in order to justify why they should be allowed to offer their therapies. And the major mental health organizations appeal to communitarian ethics when they complain that such therapies create a hostile climate. I don't know the answer to what is the ethical choice. And so all I'm going to do is I'm going to just briefly tell you where I'm at right now personally. And that doesn't hold authority for you, but it's just where I've gotten to in my struggle by reading the research, by talking to people and pondering and praying. Be very wary of anyone who promises that one's sexual desires can be deliberately changed. By all means, honor both people's sexual desires and their faith commitments as deeply woven aspects of their identity. If they are in conflict, provide support to help these people walk through, find ways to live with integrity in whatever form that may take. The Catholic Church's organization, Courage, does that. They don't try to change desires. They just try to help you grow spiritually, something that we can all benefit from. And if you want to delve more deeply into how can we come up with an ethical framework to answer these questions, I commend to you Margaret Farley's book, Just Love, A Framework for Christian Sexual Ethics. And I'm sorry I took too much time. Thank you very much.
Well, in the interest of time, we're going to hold questions for each of the panelists or each of the presenters until we have the panel discussion, if that's okay. So our next speaker.